Noble Truth. So if you've been here, this is your first time. I'm doing a series on the Four Noble Truths, and which is a central teaching of Buddhism. And as I've been saying, the emphasis in this core teaching is the importance of being open and attentive, paying attention to and exploring what is known in Buddhism as suffering. The kind of suffering that arises in our life, the dissatisfactions, the anxieties, the frustrations that arise in our life out of the way in which we choose to relate to the world around us, to relate to the things that happen to us. And the point of Buddhist practice is to become, is to release ourselves from this kind of suffering, so we don't have to live a life of anxiety, of frustration, of despair, or many of the different feelings that can arise when we choose to relate to things by holding tight to some idea, some opinion, some notion of who we are, some identity, or how things should be or how things shouldn't be. When we hold on to our likes and dislikes, when we grasp onto them, and we really like something and we have to have it, or we really dislike something and it has to go away. And the variations of that, whether it's subtle and great, are what produces a tremendous amount of stress in our life. And the way I understand stress, and maybe some of you will, it doesn't completely work, but the way I primarily understand stress is it's something we do to ourselves. Many of us in our, you know, Western society here are quite stressed out with our work and everything. But I believe that that primarily that form of the stress that we have has to do with the way we choose to relate to often what's difficult tasks to do. That somehow we resist things, or we hold on to things, or we judge things in certain ways, so that it takes a toll on our psyche and our body and we get stressed out. So to understand how we make our choices, how we do things to bring stress, to bring despair, to bring suffering to our life, is what we're asked to do when we look at the Four Noble Truths. But looking at suffering does more than just, it's more than just investigating our own suffering. But it's also being very realistic and willing to be open to the suffering we feel in the world around us. To be open to our own suffering and suffering around us. When we open to our own suffering, that becomes in Buddhism the inspiration, hopefully a joyful inspiration, to practice, to investigate, to wake up, to become mindful, to discover loving kindness and compassion. So it's inspiration for practice. It can fuel a great zeal to practice when we feel our own suffering. We feel the suffering around us and the world around us. It can do the same thing, but it also can elicit compassion. And compassion in Buddhism is considered one of the preeminent virtuous emotions or feelings or ways of relating to the world. The world needs our compassion. And so we cultivate compassion not by something, by willing ourselves to be compassionate or thinking it's a good idea, but by willing to be open and sensitive to the suffering of our friends, our neighbors, the world around us. And so as we become open to suffering and see how suffering works both in ourselves and the world around us, I believe we become sensitively aware of how grasping, how holding tightly onto things is a source of that suffering. Much of the suffering in the world around us has its genesis somewhere or other in someone's neurotic clinging to something. Or in Buddhism, holding on to anything, including your hate or your dislike, is a source of suffering. And I kind of was thinking this last week, maybe a better word than grasping for the second noble truth, which is the cause of suffering, is holding. Maybe grasping and holding, I guess grasping is holding a little bit more tightly. But it's the notion of holding is the problem. It's the suffering that arises out of grasping, holding, that Buddhism wants to address, to understand all the various forms and ways in which we grasp and hold. But what that means is that the problem that Buddhism addresses is not, Buddhism doesn't consider the world itself, anything that we become aware of, necessarily as being problematic. It isn't like we have to get rid of anything to wake up and become free. We have to release the way in which we hold it. So we're not asked to be any different than what we're doing. We're not asked necessarily to stop paying your bills or stop taking care of your neighbors or stop kind of having certain kind of aspirations and hopes and expectations or stop having certain likes and dislikes, preferences even. But what we're asked to in Buddhism is not change all that, but rather to let go, to release the holding by which we relate to those things. So can we relate to all that in an open-handed way? Can we relate to it without it having to be any particular way? Lately, I've been very fond of the Christian or the theistic expression, if God wills it kind of expression. I suppose in Buddhism we would say, if circumstances will it. This notion that it's fine to go through life with our desires, our wants, our likes and dislikes, even in our identities and ideas of who we have, who we think we should be and all that. But can we do that without that extra thing, which is holding on to it tight? We have a dislike, we don't like something. Do we have to then get it out of our life, desperately? Kick it out, avoid it. If we're in conflict with someone at work and the conflict is uncomfortable, are we then recoiling from the discomfort? And we have to get the discomfort out of our life. Or do we learn that it's okay to be with the discomfort without a strong reaction, without a pushing it away, kind of the kind of holding that's a kind of a pushing? So we try to understand what is the nature of the holding. So this distinction, I think, is very important, the distinction between the holding and the objects that we hold. Because often what spiritual practitioners will do is they feel the pain that comes from grasping. And they think that the pain arises out of the object they're grasping. And so they think the solution is to get rid of the object. And so they give up, their money, their houses, their spouses, their careers, their jobs, all their clothes, everything, whatever that is problematic, they give up. Their sexuality. But the problem is not, but the issue in Buddhism is not so much the thing, but it's really how we hold it, how we relate to it. So there's a beautiful, nice poem, cute poem, funny poem maybe, unless it's too comes home too closely, by Kabir. And this is an example of friends, Kabir says, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. What do I do about this world that I'm holding on to? And then I just spin out every time I hold, thinking that the problem is the world, not this holding. So what do I do with this world? I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the clothes were well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. Kabir says, listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path. And the path in Buddhism, as I understand it, it has to do about this knowing intimately the difference between holding to something and being present for it without the holding, kind of open-handed, in an open-handed way. So how do we go through our life with expectations, aspirations, purposes, without needing any of it to actually happen? The beautiful line in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, teach me to care and not to care. How do we care and not care at the same time? How do we actually live, be who we are fully and not deny any part of ourselves and care about our life and the life of people around us, but at the same time, in a sense, not care. In a sense, if circumstances will it, so it will be as things arise. Rather than things don't turn out the way they're supposed to be, and so then we get angry or upset or frustrated. That anger and frustration and upsetness arises because of the way in which we're holding on to something, an opinion, a demand, a control that we have, something. How can we be open? So, sometimes the second noble truth is called the source of suffering is desire. And, you know, that's a little bit problematic. But Krishnamurti writes this: as you grow older, you will find that your desires are never really fulfilled. In fulfillment, there is always the shadow of frustration. And in your heart, there is not a song, but a cry. The desire to become a great man, a great saint, a great this or that, has no end and therefore no fulfillment. Its demands are ever for the more, and such desire always breeds agony, misery, wars. But when one is free of all desire to become, there is a state of being whose action is totally different. It is. That which is has no time. It does not think in terms of fulfillment. Its very being is its fulfillment. Its very being is its fulfillment. So then we come to the third noble truth, the truth of what's called the ending of suffering, or the cessation of suffering, truth of cessation. And this is the good news of the possibility of becoming happy, of becoming free, of being freed from suffering, freed from the kind of suffering that comes from the way we grasp. And it's talked about in many ways in Buddhism, but as I was driving over here today, I was sensing or feeling and thinking about, which relates to this third noble truth, is about the present moment. We always find ourselves in the present moment, but the present moment is kind of it has some unique qualities to it. The present moment is not like the present moment is like this discrete unit of time that, you know, goes like that. You know, one discrete moment after the other. The present moment has no boundaries in time. You can't exactly say where the present moment begins and ends in time. It's like now, right? But, you know, did it just start and then now it's over? Or, you know, it has no boundaries in time. It's just kind of very spacious that way. And the present moment has no boundaries in space. It's boundless. It has space. It's quite spacious. The present moment has no time. Besides no boundaries in time, it has no time. It's only our conventions that put time on it. Now it's 7 o'clock or 6:30 or whatever, and I'm late. Those are just our thoughts and our convention. It's rather the present moment itself that we find ourselves in right now is the same present moment you always find yourself in. I mean, the present moment doesn't change because we change our circumstances or change the time of day, or our watch changes and our locations we are change. But the present moment as the present moment is still always exactly the same. It's timeless, it's boundless, it's unborn, it's uncreated. And it's marvelous. And it's closely related to the boundlessness of what maybe we call our presence, being present. You know, our presence. The presence within us, the presence of being here right now, where are the boundaries of that in time and in space? Does it have a beginning and end? Does it arise and pass away? The present moment of our life. I like it very much that presence and present are closely related. But to let go of our clinging, let go of our holding, I think is very hard for us, partly because we're so oriented in our life on the objects of attention, on the objects that we want or don't want in some way or other. And I think the mind is kind of obsessed, you know, with objects, partly because maybe if we're insecure, then we're always kind of looking out for the objects in the world that we're going to make us safe, or we look out for that which is not going to cause us any harm. Or if we feel that our fulfillment comes from external things which is going to fill us, more money, more things, more relationships, more whatever, then we're going to always be looking outside for a thing, for an object. Or if we're more the hate type, you know, and we just don't like things, then we're always going to look at that which we're going to dislike in a situation. There's, you know, three types, you know, the greed type, the hate type, and the confused type. And I know well the greed type. That's a kind of like more my thing. The desire wants everything. But it said that if the three types walk into a room, that the greed type goes and sees where the best seat is and the best person to sit next to is and the best objects in the room. And the hate type comes into the room and sees everything that's wrong with it and who they're not going to sit next to and the place they're not going to sit. And the confused type just comes in and doesn't know what to do. Not sure of anything. So we tend to focus on objects. And if we have some kind of neurotic compulsion, whatever, for in any one of these three ways or for objects, for what's out there, what we're not going to notice so well is the state of being when the clinging has released itself, when the clinging or holding onto the object has released itself. And we're not going to find that in that state can be a very profound sense of fulfillment, of wholeness. That we think, oh, something else is going to do it for me. And as Krishnamurti says, I believe that as long as we desire something outside of ourselves, we'll never really be fulfilled. There'll be temporary moments of satisfaction, but then, we want the next thing and something else. So, to begin to appreciate the state of being, the state of existence, the state of non-holding, of non-clinging, in small ways, become recognize it. And to recognize it's probably a much more frequent part of your life, our life, than we're probably already aware of. Because we're so quick to get into the objects, the other things we want or don't want, or our preoccupations, to take some moment and say, what is this? When we release, when we let go, we're not holding on. What is that like? What does that feel like, getting to know that? What does a timeless present feel like? We don't tend to relate to the timelessness of the present moment, the spaciousness of the present moment, because it's not an object that's going to do anything for us. It's not going to do much for our status or for our bank book or for, our relationships or at least we think it's the moment. Maybe it does a lot inadvertently, but so we tend not to focus on it. So the release. So what we look at in Buddhism is when we suffer, we get interested in it. And what's this curious thing? Now, one option we have, of course, is when you suffer, is to suffer on top of it. You start suffering and say, "Oh shit, I can't stand this." It's bad enough to suffer, and then to on top of it say, "Oh shit, I can't stand it." Okay. And then someone hears you and you get embarrassed. And so that, so embarrassment, that's a third layer of suffering on top of that. But how do we leave things alone? So we don't add any more grasping to it. I talk about the given. And probably many of you have heard this before. I love the expression the given. What's the given? We say, it's given. It's obvious. It's what's obvious. But the given is what is obvious in the present moment is the given. What is given to us in the present moment? What arises and what we're aware of directly? I like to think of it as the given because it's a gift. Here it is. And how then do we relate to what's given to us? Do we relate to it with judgment or criticism or desire or wanting? Or do we relate to it through openness and allowingness and with all the things that come with that, with compassion and loving kindness and care and sensitivity? But how do we relate to what's given to us? Because what we're doing in Buddhism, in a sense, we can say, is not becoming liberated or free ourselves. That's a little bit of a... It's very dangerous to think that, I'm doing this Buddhist practice so I can become enlightened or liberated or free or whatever. Because in a subtle way, that's probably just another little holding that we add on top of what's already here. It's an extra little thing. I think maybe it's more accurate to say what we're doing is we're giving freedom to all the objects of the world. To all the things that are given to us, we're giving its freedom by not holding on to it. So we're not getting enlightened. Everything we come into contact with is becoming enlightened by us. Now, is that a relief? Or is that kind of like, oh my God, why was I doing all this? I couldn't care less about all the objects. I want, it's for me, right? But it's really, how do we release all the things around us? So how do we relate to the given? How do we release the given? And so we start with what's given to us. And what's obvious in the present moment. If what's obvious is suffering, how do we relate to the suffering? So we don't add any more suffering on top of it. When it's happiness, when it's some really happy event, how do we relate to that given without clinging to that? Or without setting up expectation or desire? To letting that just be. The beautiful thing is that if it's a happy event, and you say you clamp onto it as this has to be, and I better hold on to this as long as I possibly can, then if you're sensitive, you'll feel that that is suffering. And if you're sensitive to suffering, and kind of make it a little bit of something you become sensitive to, then you become less interested in wanting to grasp onto that which is pleasant, to make it last. Because you feel that that's actually adding suffering on top of what's basically a great time. So just leave it be, to be open-handed. So how do we relate to what's actually happening to us without adding anything onto it? So as I've often said, you know, say that you sit here and you're suffering and you say, oh shit, you know, not this again. And then someone hears you and you get embarrassed. And they say, oh my God, I'm a meditation teacher and I shouldn't be embarrassed. And I'm such a bad person. Something's wrong with me. And then I get depressed. And we add all these layers of reactivity. So say I find myself, suddenly I kind of finally wake up to what's going on when I'm really depressed about myself. At that moment, what is it like to be free then? What is it like to free my depression? Not to get rid of it. It's very important to notice the difference between releasing the holding and getting rid of something. So what is it like to relate to that depression so you don't add another kink, another layer of reactivity, of holding, of clinging, or pushing away to it? Oh, I'm depressed. So we do that. So in the third noble truth, the truth of cessation, it can be understood in two general ways. One way is it's the moment-to-moment releasing of the holding that's possible in the moment-to-moment experiences of our living. I'm angry with being depressed. Anger is kind of a holding, holding onto a judgment perhaps. I let go of the holding to the judgment, and the judgment just is free. It probably disappears, floats away. And that is a moment of cessation. That's a moment of being free of a holding. And we can feel what that's like. There might be still a lot of suffering left, because after all, the depression came out of a whole series of other things. But that's a moment of freedom. And that is what we're very much looking at in mindfulness, is the moment-to-moment experience of understanding what's going on, understanding where the actual operating holding is, and then understanding it well enough that it releases itself, not adding anything to it. So that's one way of understanding cessation. The other way is that if this becomes a familiar enough part of your life, the experience of not holding on, but just being open-handed, open-minded to experience, and it becomes more familiar part of our experience, and we can do it with more continuity, that our life then opens up to the timeless, the deathless, the fearless. It opens up to the experience of what's called Nibbana or Nirvana. And the Nibbana means, the best translation into English I've heard of the word Nirvana is unbinding. Nirvana is an unbinding. It's when we unbind ourselves to all the holding, all the ways we tie ourselves up through the second noble truth. And the experience of doing that quite thoroughly will give us this taste that of this reality, in a sense, that is always here. Because the present moment, the timelessness of the present moment, where is it? Is it tomorrow? Or did you miss your chance yesterday? You know, it's always right here. Practice is really about what's happening right now. The place where we find practice, the place where we find our life, the place where we wake up and become free, can't be anywhere else but right here. And what is this right here? What is this right here that we find ourselves in? And so Buddhism puts a tremendous, is tremendously affirmative of the life that we find ourselves in, because where else is it going to be? But what is it like to be in this world without holding of anything? Now that experience of nibbana, of not holding, is sometimes called a form of great happiness. It's called, it's called that which is secure, the security, safety. It's called great peace. But there's two sides to cessation, just like there's two sides to confrontation with suffering. Two sides of suffering is knowing our own and being inspired to practice, and being more in contact with that of others, and then having compassion arise. I think the two sides of cessation is the peace and the joy that can arise from not holding anymore. And in that open-handedness, that open-heartedness, there is the increased sensitivity then to the people around us, to the world around us. So the practice is to become sensitive, to open ourselves, pay attention to what's going on within us and around us. And the fruition of practice, which is the cessation of holding, again, beautifully then connects us. It can't do anything else but connect us to our fellow living beings in the world, because there's no barriers. To let go of holding is to also let go of the barriers between me and you. So, to teach me to care and not to care. I really love this idea that the Buddhist practice doesn't really ask us, in the essence of it, to change anything about who we are. But it asks us to do this thing which maybe is much more challenging and frightening, is to let go of the way we hold onto all the things. So if we have a lot of money, it's fine to have a lot of money, but can you let go of the holding onto it? If you're a woman or a man, it's fine to be a woman or a man, but can you be a woman or a man without holding onto it? Okay, or whatever. And we hold on to all kinds of things. We hold on to youth. We hold on to health. We hold on to people wanting people to like us. We hold on to our pleasure. So the cessation of holding is also called the deathless. It's said that in this timeless, deathless state of non-holding, there is no arising and passing, there's no birth and no death, no sickness and old age. That what is discovered through this is a way of being, a way, a reality in a sense, which is completely other from birth and death, and old age and sickness. All of us get old, all of us get sick, and all of us die. And if we find our security, if we try to get our security in the world of conditions that change and rise and pass, it's not going to be safe. We're never going to really find that peace that's possible. But in the midst of all that, without separating ourselves from all the world that we live in, because nirvana is not something separate, but it also is. But it's to be here with, let it all be free. Let it all, in that there is the deathless, there is unchanging. And to find ourselves, to find our security, our peace, our reference in that which is deathless provides a tremendous ease in our life. And it makes it a lot easier than to go through our life without needing to hold on. So as you go about your days and your practice, you can make that a theme. Notice the difference between holding and not holding. What is it like? What does it feel like? I could feel it when I came and sat here this evening, because when I first sat down, I could feel that the cumulative effect of my day was in the way my thoughts were kind of racing around, was in the way my breathing was in the way in which my body was, and that it was a result of holding. You can kind of feel it in your body, kind of. And as I kept sitting here and just relating to it openly, not requiring it to be any different or trying to change it or trying to make myself more comfortable or just simply being open to experience it, there's this slow settling and releasing that happens. And by the end of the sitting, there was a great difference between the state of holding and not holding. And to be sensitive, what is that like? And then in that state of some relative degree of less holding, then we go back into the world. We go out and talk with friends, go to work and do our things. And what happens if we hold slightly? Let me hold, I shouldn't use the word. If we just maintain that reference slightly of what it was like not to hold, can we become more sensitive to when we begin holding, when we begin grasping? Not to criticize it or be upset or blame it or use it for judgment or anything, but simply so we can understand it better, understand it earlier. So the value of studying the state of non-holding, of non-clinging, being sensitive to it. So it's a very bizarre religion, Buddhism, because the highest state, the ultimate thing that Buddhism has to offer, doesn't exist. Right? But we're out front about it. Does it exist? Does non-clinging exist? Where do you point to non-clinging? But you're not going to say it doesn't not exist either, does it? So, oh, I'm sorry. I just talked away. I meant to give more time for discussion. So what do you want to say? Yes.
Very often when I go to the work, when I have a conflict, I stop and I want to resolve it in the Buddhist way. What would a good Buddhist do in this situation? And particularly when it's a matter of what I think, how do I think something should be done, how does somebody else, you know, I have to express my opinion. So I want to express it but not hold on to it.
Yeah.
Let it go. It becomes a feeling of, oh well, whatever.
No, yeah, that,
and it sometimes feels like I'm not standing up for myself. And it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that to care and not to care doesn't translate to, oh, whatever happens, fine. You know, it's really to care about things and really be even very concerned and responsible and follow through. And in doing that, in being really attentive to the particulars, to the details, and taking care of things, and taking care of, you know, to the particulars and also the wider picture of things, really doing that, then whatever. It's not like whatever, you know, whatever what happens, I don't care, my hands, I rid myself of the problem. It's really, you know, being engaged. And in the engagement, there can be, oh, well, whatever happens is fine, but this is what I'm doing. I'm engaged, and this is where I stand, this is how I feel. And it can be a great relief to other people to hear that you're engaged and really responsible, and you're not attached to it. If other people feel that in you, it's a lot easier for them to come and talk to you. And this is really great, you know, she has a really important opinion, you know, and maybe I disagree with her, but I can go talk to her because I know that even though she's, you know, really responsible and careful and follows through on things, I can go talk to her about opinion because she's not going to be defensive about it. She's going to tell me what she thinks, you know, and give me good reasons. But it's really easy to talk to her because she doesn't get defensive. So your question is too general, I feel, for a specific answer. Because anything specific I say will kind of, there's exceptions. But one of the things to explore, you know, one of the things a Buddhist does is to pay attention to the situation. An important part of what the situation is our involvement in it, the way in which we relate to the situation. And if there's a very strong holding in the situation, if you're emotionally kind of tied up in it, someone does something, you get angry, and you might want to look very carefully at the anger and then decide whether you want to deal with it while you're still in the state of anger, while you're still being colored by that nature, that kind of holding, or you want to give it a day or give it a couple hours, until you're no longer in the grip of the holding that you have, And then go and come, not just, you know, then wait, just wait 2 hours until you're cool and say, well, I don't need to talk about it now because, you know. But then reevaluate the situation, and when you don't feel like you're caught in the grip of something, then go back and engage. And you can probably talk much more realistically or valuably when you can talk from a place that doesn't have that kind of holding. That's one way a Buddhist would do it. If you have the choice, sometimes you don't have the choice, and sometimes you got to act and to deal with things, in, you know, even if you're upset. And then you try to do the best you can. Is that... Yes?
The things you were saying about not holding somebody who has a lot of money, which I can't hardly relate to that, but the idea of not holding, and you're saying not holding being a man,
yeah. Well, it means, well, for the example of having a lot of money, holding onto the money is, you know, to be completely preoccupied about how much money you have, and to every day go home and count your money and check your bank statements, and it's very important for you to be a rich person because that's your persona is tied up in being a rich person, and so you have to keep enough wealth so that you can kind of go to the right country clubs and you know, be seen by the right people. And the money represents a lot of things, and so we're holding on to a lot of things. We're holding on to our identity, our status, our security. We're holding on to our fears about the future and all kinds of things. As opposed to simply not holding on to any of that, but being very responsible for with our life and what we do to take care of our life and live a basically, you know, secure life. But you know, there's a huge difference between, you know, holding on to that and just holding it and being responsible and taking care of it with open hands. Not being, you know, a man or a woman. You know, I'm a woman. You know, I'm a man, say, you know. And so... But being a man comes with certain things, right? So being a man, what does it come with? What does it come with? What? Flying fighter airplanes. Yeah, having certain cars. You know, so I have, you know, it's very important to be seen a certain way as a man. So I have to have certain cars, or I have to have fighter airplanes, you know, or... You know, real man, I have to be a real man, and so it's very important that the people see me as being a real man. So I'm holding on to my idea of what a man is. It's a lot easier just to be a man without having an idea of what a man is supposed to be. Right? So just to be a man open-handedly. And even if I have ideas of what it's like to be a man, not to hold on to those opinions or those values or those ideas. So not to hold on to an opinion. So if I believe that, you know, that all men should wear blue socks, and any man who doesn't wear blue socks, you know, is not really a full-fledged man. Well, that's, you know, a strange idea, but whatever, you know. But if I'm holding on to that, this is really true, and this is, you know, I got to have it this way, and it's important, and I'm going to judge everybody else because I think they're wrong, because that's holding on to it. As opposed to just, you know, that's what I believe. I think that's true, and who cares? You know, I don't really, you know, I'm not going to make any decisions based on that. I'm not going to hate anybody because of it, or... I'm not going to get upset because I can't find any blue socks at home. Does that make some sense? I'm just kind of... Is it helpful? Or not having money. You said you don't have money. So we have an opinion of what that means. And so we hold on to that opinion really tight. You know, what it means not to have money. Maybe you think it's really glorious. You know, you're, you know, a self-righteous, radical, simple kind of anarchist. And you think, you know, everybody should have any money. So it's really important. You're clinging to this notion, and then you inherit, you know, $1 million from your uncle. You know, and suddenly, you know, it's really, you know, painful because you're holding on to this one way of being. Yes.
You kind of have to examine the opposite, and then accept that.
Meaning what?
Whatever it is that you might be holding on to, whether it's your opinion in the workplace about how you think something should be done. Do you have to look at what the opposite is?
The opposite opinion, yep.
The opposite opinion and say, well, I may not agree with that, but under these, I guess I could live with it in, in this way, and therefore I can at least be open to the fact that it might happen.
I suppose, yeah. It's always good to have... Opinions are opinions, right? And they're just interpretations. And so we should know that. And there's always two, at least two different points of view in any given situation. So if we know that, then we're not going to hold on to the interpretation so tightly, our opinion so tightly. And maybe it isn't so true. So we kind of begin softening at the opinion. So we have a little softer attitude to it. And you might say, it's my opinion that men should wear blue socks, as opposed to saying, men better wear blue socks, and that's the way it's going to be where I work. What?
I have a problem with the idea of the opposite opinion. I think there is one. It assumes a black and white world in which there is a total polarity. And the longer I live, the muddier and browner the world looks.
So you're less likely to hold on to your opinions then. Good.
Well, or there may be a lot of them.
A lot of opinions. Just lots of opinions. So, should we hold on to the evening or should we go home?